Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
For anyone to be appointed or made a public officer, there are prerequisites. It's either you get letter of exemption or you must have served the nation in the National Youth Service Corps. The minister in question has not discharged either of the board.
Nigeria human rights activists petitioned a high court to challenge the appointment of Mrs. Hanatu Musawa as minister.
We certainly polled their views and researched their views on different countries and cultures. So, for instance, for France, there was across the board a really quite unfavourable view of France, of the French, of French policy towards Gabon and Africa.
A poll shows Gabon's decision to join the Commonwealth of Nations is popular among a majority of the population.
That has always been our position. We have expressed willingness to dialogue because we know as a country we cannot move further if we don't dialogue. And we've expressed it unequivocally on several occasions.
And Sierra Leone's main opposition party welcomes plans by the administration in Freetown to engage in dialogue. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, two leading human rights activists have jointly filed a legal petition at the Abuja High Court challenging the appointment of Mrs. Hanatu Musawa as Minister for Arts, Culture and Creative Economy. Deji Adeyanju, convener of the group called Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, and Patrick Iholo, the founder of the One Love Foundation, contend in the lawsuit that the appointment is illegal. They also want her to resign or be fired. This after confirmation that Musawa is currently serving as a member of the National Youth Service Corps. The activists contend that the president flouted the law by appointing and subsequently swearing in Musawa, who has yet to complete her service as a member of the National Youth Service Corps. It is a requirement for Nigerian university graduates to serve in the Corps for a year. For more about their lawsuit challenging the legality of the cabinet minister, I reach Deji Adeyanju in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
It's premised on the position of the law. The law is clear that for anyone to be appointed or made a public officer, there are prerequisites. It's either you get letter of exemption or you must have served the nation in the National Youth Service Corps. And the minister in question has not discharged either of the burden.
Where do things go from here? Because some of these issues came up when immediately she was appointed and people raised issues. However, the president has sworn in as a cabinet minister.
Should we then say that because illegality and impunity has been condoned, should that not become the norm? Certainly not. You know, societies must operate on its own agreed rules and regulations. And just like the holding of the Supreme Court in the case of Ojukwu and Lagos State Government, that nobody needs rule of law and to obey the law more than the government, because it is with it that they govern. That without it, the government can absolutely achieve nothing or do nothing. And therefore, that at all times, the government must set examples by obeying its own laws. It is in so doing that citizens will not resort to self-help. And you can see that there is, you know, an increasing amount of citizens resorting to self-help in the country, from criminality, criminal gangs here and there, all over the geopolitical zones of the country, because there seems to be a semblance of the government not wanting to obey rule of law. So government at all times must comply with its own rules and regulations, which are captured and encapsulated in the ground norm, which is the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria.
Now, Deji, I'm sure you've heard some of her supporters saying that there's no law in Nigeria that bars a serving corps to hold a political office or, for that matter, be appointed for cabinet position. And some of them are also saying that a court case was brought against the president for submitting less than 36 names as proposed by law, and that things are going on as usual, ignored, they said, by the government, and this will also be ignored. Your take?
Yeah, illegality will always have supporters from time immemorial. And so this should not be an exception to the rule. However, You know, there are numerous and plethora of laws, including the holding of a Supreme Court, just like we have annexed in the processes forwarded, you know, where acts like these have been prohibited. The NYC law prohibits it. Even the civil public service rules prohibit it. Even her the rules and oath of office that she has taken as minister also prohibits it. You cannot be drawing two salaries, you know, at the same time. You know, so there are several other issues which the processes are seeking interpretation of the court. Thankfully, there's a case that falls on all fours with this institution of this matter, you know, where the court had already made a definite pronouncement in that regard. So I think it would be a straitjacket issue.
Some are suggesting that if this was an illegality, then Senate should not have vetted her. She shouldn't have gone through the process. She's been vetted and cleared by the Senate, and that will serve as a defense for her in this court petition. Your take?
Someone submitted a blank sheet of paper to the Senate, and he was cleared. You know, so, and that is to show you the quality of parliamentarians that we have. You know, again, also the vetting process at the DSS has been called to question in this regard. And the DSS detected some irregularities in some of the nominees. But why couldn't they detect this one? You know, so these are reasons why we need to always do what is right. So because younger ones are watching and taking notes.
So Deji, does the petition also ask the president to either fire her or call for her resignation?
Yeah, basically, this should naturally culminate into the president leaving her of her duty. You know, the moral and legal burden that we bear as citizens and that the leaders bear, it should be a collective one. It shouldn't be one that is only reserved when things are done in one or the other's favor. You know, it should have laws, should have general application, and nobody should be above them.
Deji Adeyanju is convener of the group called Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. In Gabon, a recent poll shows the decision to join the Commonwealth of Nations is popular among a majority of the population. The public also wants the country to have a closer relationship with its international partners, including the US, China, and India. Conducted by BTP Advisors, the 18-month-long market research shows a majority of the people are not happy with policies of France towards Gabon. This, despite France being a former colonial master to Gabon. The outcome of the survey came weeks ahead of the elections, which the incumbent president Ali Bongo Ondimba was declared the winner. But the opposition rejected the outcome as rigged. Shortly afterwards, the Bongo administration was deposed by the military. For more about the market research and the latest development following the overthrow of the Bongo administration, I reach Mark Percy. He is the chief executive officer of BTP Advisors.
We conducted 18 months worth of very in-depth voter research, testing sentiment to understand voters' responses and to different policies, voters' beliefs in the future of the country, the direction of the country, voters' views on the important issues that affected their lives, their reaction to different politicians, their favorability. We certainly polled their views and researched their views on different countries and cultures. So, for instance, for France, there was across the board a really quite unfavorable view of France, of the French, of French policy towards Gabon and Africa. What there wasn't negativity towards was French culture. I mean, obviously, Gabon shares a lot of similarities with French culture, the language. People watch French films, eat French-inspired food. There's a great love of French culture, just not of French politics. And indeed, of the countries that we tested, we also looked at China, US, UK, British Commonwealth, and China. we found that France was the least popular of those countries. I mean, it might be a case, I suppose, Peter, of a case of familiarity breeds contempt. But I think that it was pretty stark, the difference between France and the reaction to other countries.
So let's talk about the big elephant in the room, the overthrow of the Bongo administration. Shortly after the election results were announced, showing that the president had won 64% of the total vote count. Of course, the opposition rejected the outcome, saying it was rigged. And then shortly afterwards, there was a coup. What do you make of it? Because some observers are saying that perhaps the coup had been in the offing or in the planning stage for a long time, and that probably they took advantage of the situation and overthrew his administration. Your thoughts?
Well, I agree with those observers. I think they're right. I think this coup was well organized, and it was organized in advance. I don't think it was a reaction to the election result or its announcement. The coup went too smoothly for that. Let me just give you a couple of examples of why I think this is the case. On the morning that the election result was declared, Nureddin, the son of the president, the communications director, Jesse, and others were travelling back to Nureddin's house to have some drinks, have a celebration. They knew the result was going to be announced in the next hour or so, and they were going back home to, have some drinks as people usually do after an election. And immediately after the result was declared nationally on the television, the soldiers who were guarding them in the house turned on them and arrested them. And, you can't tell me that, the coup leader or the military woke up in the morning, didn't like the result and thought, let's have a coup. No. They were planning this for some time. Things don't work that smoothly in any walk of life if they're not planned.
What do you think will happen based on your research? Do you think your research would have any bearing at all on the latest development? And where do you see Gabon in the next few weeks to come?
Well, I think today we have the inauguration of the coup leader as the transitional president, as he's calling himself. So I think that the opposition's hope, as seemed to be the case on Wednesday, that they would get together with the military and come to some arrangement whereby the military would hand over to the opposition, clearly is not happening. And I think you can see the opposition leader did an interview on TV5, French TV channel, I think overnight, in which he extraordinarily accused the coup leader of being in cooperation with Ali Bongo, the idea that the president somehow overthrew himself, which is obviously nonsense. But clearly the idea that the opposition hoped they would have some sort of handover is not happening, and I would say that it would be a case that the coup leaders will be in power for some time. How long is difficult to say. I think we can see from other countries, transitions become a year, become 2 years, become 3 years, and then people take off their military uniform and put on a suit and then suddenly become a candidate for election. There's a fairly well-trodden path, in other places where we've seen this happen, or something like it. So I fear that, sadly, that is what we're due for in Gabon.
Mark Percy is the Chief Executive Officer of BTP Advisors. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. In Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Party, or APC, has welcomed plans by the administration in Freetown to engage in dialogue. The APC says the willingness to engage in dialogue to resolve concerns will reduce tensions and ensure unity and national cohesion. The remarks come after the government received a report from the Independent Commission for Peace and National Cohesion. The group had met with all stakeholders, including the APC,
as part of its effort towards post-election reconciliation by providing a platform for dialogue between the ruling Sierra Leone's People's Party, or SLPP, and the APC. The government expressed support for the work of the organization while encouraging the involvement of both local and international institutions such as the Commonwealth and the African Union, who have expressed interest in being mediators. For more reaction from the main opposition APC, I reach Abdoulaye Kagbo. He is a parliamentarian and a leading member of the APC.
Yes, of course. That has always been our position. We have expressed willingness to dialogue because we know as a country we cannot move further if we don't dialogue. And we've expressed it unequivocally on several occasions. Even with previous interviews I've had with you, I've made it essentially clear that the main opposition is very prepared and willing to dialogue. So if government also has agreed to dialogue, and this dialogue must be led by independent international arbiters. So we are having the Commonwealth and EU, you know, so to us it's a good news.
Does that mean that the APC would decide to stop its decision to boycott all system of governance, including going to parliament?
No, of course, the actions of the APC party is going to be predicated on the outcomes of the dialogue. Like I said, we have formed a team as a party, you know, a negotiating team that will put the needs of the party together, you know, the demands of the party together. So I'm sure it is after the dialogue, how the outcome of the dialogue will look like is how the party will participate in governance.
So what are your expectations of this dialogue? Because you have made, the APC has made a demand for a rerun of the election and for the election results to be released by the Electoral Commission of Sierra Leone, the ECL. Are these demands going to be key in these upcoming negotiations or dialogue with the government, or you are going to have a dialogue without preconditions to resolve any concerns to move the country forward?
Well, firstly, we have to look at the credibility of the elections, because as a political party, even when we know that the elections are not credible, we cannot say, let's forge ahead with governance. You know, that's a recipe for previous elections to be rigged again. So we have to look at the credibility of these elections, and that will form part of our demands.
What has been the reaction of the top leadership of the party and your supporters after the government decided that, okay, we need to sit down and have this dialogue?
Well, of course, like I said, we were at a NAC meeting, and in that meeting, consensusly, all the members of NAC agreed that the party should go to a dialogue. And the mere fact that we've agreed as a political party to go to dialogue, you know, we are looking also forward to government to also do the same. And now that government has agreed also to go to dialogue, I believe it's a good way to forge ahead.
What do you think this means, since both sides have agreed to sit down and have this dialogue? What does this mean for the people of Sierra Leone?
Well, it means a lot. It means a lot. It means that in Sierra Leone, we believe in solving our problems, you know, using the table than any other means. And it means that the main opposition believes in negotiation, the main opposition believes in dialogue, and the main opposition, you know, prioritizes dialogue over any other means of solving or resorting our problem.
Mm. So, Mr. Kagbo, before you go, what will be the message of the APC in this dialogue, and what do you think the people of Sierra Leone should expect from this dialogue?
Well, of course, the message of the APC is that our stance are all as a result of the fact that APC believes in having power through democratic means, and we don't want to compromise that belief, and we don't want to encourage any scintilla of doubt that will be created in the minds of party members that it is impossible for any other party to win elections through democratic means. You know, that is our main concern, because APC is a democratic political party, you know. So we are particularly concerned that the democratic tenets are not watered down in this very country, and that people do not, you know, dismiss the view that you will win elections through democratic means. You know, we want the confidence of Sierra Leoneans to be regained, that elections will no longer be rigged, and what happened in these elections, you know, can no longer happen. You know, that is why we are very emphatic on the credibility of the elections and say our best can be corrected. So, to as a party, we are forcing, because you could remember that APC contested in 2018 elections. We were in governance, and the chief electoral commissioner was appointed by the former president. You know, but the chief electoral commissioner publicly announced that APC lost the elections, and we handed over peacefully. So we want that democratic tenet to be maintained in our country, that kind of culture.
Abdoulaye Kagbo is a Sierra Leonean parliamentarian and a leading member of the opposition APC. He spoke with me from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown. Yeah. In Liberia, the presidential candidate of the opposition Liberian National Union, or LINU, is predicting victory in a second round in the presidential contest in the coming general election. Clarence Moniba says he has received offers from other opposition parties to form an alliance before the polls. At 45 years old, he is a former consultant for the African Development Bank, the UN, the World Bank, and the youngest cabinet minister, who also headed the Liberia Electricity Corporation. Moniba has expressed confidence he has the experience and the track record of solving problems, which he says makes him stand out among the other candidates. Analysts say the opposition parties could have a shot at winning the presidential election if they join forces and present a single candidate. This, they say, will help the opposition blunt the advantages that incumbent President George Weah enjoys. Liberians go to the polls on October 10 to choose a new president, House of Representatives, and half of the Senate. Presidential candidate Clarence Moniba tells me that he will become the next president of Liberia.
So far, I'm very happy about what we've been able to do. And I'm also so proud to be leading this generational fight. 85% of the people in Liberia are under the age of 45. So we already know and understand that if we are going to change and develop and transform this country, it is going to be our generation. And so that's the message we have been giving to every single person we meet. Liberia is going to be a great country one day, and it is up to us, our generation, to ensure it happens.
Are you saying that Liberia is not great at the moment and never been great?
Absolutely not. When you look at the conditions of the people living in Liberia, you immediately understand that most of the people in Liberia live as if they're living in 1923. A majority of the people in Liberia live in mud houses. They have outside toilets. There's no electricity. The suffering is clear. The deprivation is clear. And so because of that, we understand that Liberia has not been great in the past. Even today's present state, we already know that also today the conditions of Liberians is not good enough for anybody living in Liberia.
So what makes Clarence Moniba uniquely qualified to become the next president of Liberia? Why do you think the people of Liberia should repose confidence in you to choose you as the next president?
I'm proud to say, I have two masters and a PhD, so highly educated, but then also highly experienced too, working for the United Nations as a consultant, the World Bank as a consultant, African Development Bank as a consultant, also serving as a Minister of State without portfolio, the youngest cabinet member in the previous administration, serving as the youngest chairman of the Liberia Electricity Corporation, where I oversaw a lot of infrastructure development and also helped to negotiate for hundreds of millions of dollars of infrastructure development in Liberia. I've also served as the head of the Presence Delivery Unit, which oversaw all of the major infrastructure development in the country. And so we have the education, we have the experience, and most importantly, we have the character and the vision to transform Liberia. And so I think when you put all of these together, I think we present the best option to the people of Liberia, especially when you look at the fact that this country, we need a new breed of leaders in this country.
You've heard people talking about you being unmarried and not being in any romantic relationship. Some people are saying if you don't have that aspect, although that is not constitutionally required, they cannot trust you. Your response to that?
You know, and that's the mistake that people make. I have a son who I'm very proud of, who lives with me. And I think it's more important to understand that if marriage was a qualifier, then we should not all be running to unseat President Weah. I'm a family man. I love the family that I have. And the focus for the Liberian people is more than that. When you look at the opposition in this country, Most of them are in their 70s and late 60s and early 70s. I told you before that the majority of the country is young. We have one of the youngest countries on the continent of Africa. That's why now it's up to us to make that transformation, to show to the people of Liberia that we do have a good country, we do have a great country, and we can do so by all working together. And so that's what the Liberian people care about.
Well, some people are suggesting that if you have any chance of defeating the incumbent with all the power and advantages that go with the power of incumbency, then you should join hands with other opposition groups in order to have a fighting chance of defeating him. Are there plans for you to form an alliance with any party in the run-up to the election, or you intend to go it alone?
So a lot of people have been calling just an hour ago. I got off the phone with a political party that is talking about collaboration. But at the end of the day, I'm confident that it's going to go to a second round. And whoever emerges in the second round, we hope and pray that it's going to be us because of our message, because of our background, because of our ability. We hope and pray that it's going to be us in the second round. And that's when the true consolidation will emerge to go against the incumbent president.
Clarence Moniba is the presidential candidate of the opposition Liberian National Union, or LINU. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. In South Africa, BRICS leaders agreed at the recent meeting in South Africa to allow two African countries to join the group. Ethiopia and Egypt joined Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Observers say the entry of both Egypt and Ethiopia will significantly boost growth in their respective countries. Some have suggested the BRICS group will soon move forward with discussions not to use the dollar for future transactions, a move critics say appears to push back on sanctions imposed on Russia. Meanwhile, the Itikowitz Foundation and Iakovenko Foundation for Peace, Dialogue and Reconciliation have announced plans to restore the Mandela mural in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. This following the recent BRICS summit held in South Africa. For more on BRICS welcoming new members, the alleged de-dollarization and plans to restore the Nelson Mandela mural in Kyiv, I reach Ivo Itikowitz. He is the founder of the Itikowitz Foundation.
I think this is a very significant step in the right direction for BRICS. I think BRICS as a concept was becoming very stale. I think that the expectation that South Africa would act as a gateway to Africa and would therefore represent the rest of the continent was flawed right from the very beginning. I think that there are economies in Africa that have a huge amount to add to the BRICS collective. They are fast-growing economies, they're exciting economies, and that they should be involved in BRICS directly. And I think that this is a very good step in the right direction. I also think that it gives BRICS new impetus at a time when, frankly, it was floundering and having great difficulty finding a purpose. I would have expected that Nigeria would have been a much more viable next African country to join, but I think Ethiopia is a meaningful economy. It's an important economy, and I'm personally very encouraged to see Ethiopia as the first step in a much broader African participation.
Now, Ivo, the issue of de-dollarization has been going on for some time now, and people were even anticipating that a BRICS summit would have discussed that and acted as a counterweight to the what people say the almighty dollar. What are your thoughts?
Look, I think we all know that de-dollarization today is a ludicrous fantasy. We mustn't forget that the dollar is the most important reserve currency, not because it's imposed on anybody, but because it's the currency that most people are the most comfortable with. I don't think there's any meaningful fear of the dollar losing its dominance in the near future. However, this is a real wake-up call to the world. It's a wake-up call to the West in that the fact that we're even talking about moving the primary currency of trade away from the dollar is talking to a dissatisfaction, in my view, with the fact that the United States has now, or the perception is that the United States has started weaponizing the dollar. This, in my view, is a reaction to the fact that sanctions are biting hard. They're not just biting in Russia and in countries that are involved in this conflict, but they're also hurting Africa, they're hurting China, they're hurting other developing economies. And I think that this is all about a, let's call it a protest against the weaponization of the dollar. I think the bigger the chance is that there will be a new trade currency that will be viable and that will eventually become a threat to the dollar.
On the Independence Day of Ukraine, your family foundation, in partnership with Ukraine's Kovenko Foundation for Peace, Dialogue and Reconciliation, announced that you have commissioned the restoration of the Mandela mural in central Kiev. Talk to me about it and how this is important for the people of Ukraine and South Africa.
This project was motivated by the fact that there was a lot of elements in Ukrainian society at the time that resonated with what Nelson Mandela stood for. They resonated with his approach towards reconciliation, his approach towards dialogue, his approach towards peacemaking. And we were very excited about the project at the time. And when the war broke out, somebody asked me and said, well, what had become of the mural? And I hadn't been to Kiev for some time, and I asked, and I discovered that this mural had in fact been badly defaced by pro-Russian separatists. And this damaged mural has been watching over the war in Kiev for some time. And we've decided that Ukraine needs to start looking into the future. Ukraine needs to start looking towards the next chapter and towards a concept of reconciliation. And we've started a process with the Yakovenko Foundation to completely reconstruct the mural.
Ivo Ichikowitz is the founder of the Ichikowitz Foundation. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Uganda, the Justice and Constitutional Affairs Minister, Norbert Mao, has sharply denied allegations he received undisclosed funds from the ruling party to contest in the last presidential election. Mao, who is the head of the Opposition Democratic Party, or DP, says the allegations that he received dirty cash to sponsor his presidential bid in the 2021 presidential election are unfounded, recycled, and malicious. His denial came after some of the leaders of the opposition party accused Mao of collecting monies from undisclosed sources to fund his campaign. This after stating the party did not have funds to support its presidential candidate in the general election. Dr. Lulume Baiga, a member of parliament from the opposition DP, tells me that the party failed to establish where Mao got the money to sponsor his presidential effort.
We became suspicious that the then president of the party wanted to contest in an election in which members of the Democratic Party did not have the resources to run a presidential campaign. Many of the outstanding members were going for their elections in their respective constituencies, and they too did not have the resources to run very well a parliamentary campaign. But he was a man who didn't really have a job, but who wanted to contest for a presidency and didn't have anything to show that he had the capability to mobilize any resources. And I personally advised him not to run for president, because he was going to embarrass the party because of an ill-prepared election campaign.
Are you therefore saying the money that he got to run for the election was so-called, in quote, as they say in Uganda, dirty money?
I want to say that we could not really ascertain where resources could come from. But according to his assistant then, He got a lot of money and ran a very spendthrift campaign. He had a number of new vehicles which were branded DP. And we are seeing those of the FDC had similar vehicles, new vehicles, pickups, which were branded in FDC colors, which means that somehow the resources came from a similar source. And we did not have enough time to interrogate the source of this funding and how much of that funding came to him and how much he spent in his presidential elections.
Dr. Baiga, the question a lot of people are asking is, why wasn't an investigation conducted if there were suspicions surrounding how he got money to fund his presidential campaign the last time?
We raise issues in formal democratic spaces, such as the National Executive Committee and the National Council. Some of us do not sit on the National Executive Committee, but we sit on the parliament of the party called the National Council. And that is, those are the spaces where we could do formally interrogate these issues without them spilling over into the media, because we are not that type of people who want to spill things in the media. The opportunity to have a National Executive Committee was denied. And even the opportunity to have a National Council, therefore, it followed, could not be given until we saw him crossing to the NRM and getting a job as a Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs. So we could not interrogate internally the officers concerned. But maybe now they feel there is an escape route in order for us not to interrogate it.
Well, but Norbert Mao, describe the allegations made by you and your other colleagues as recycled, unfounded, and malicious, and probably some form of jealousy because he has decided to work as a statesman and not politically biased with the government.
We have seen people nicknaming themselves statesmen, but you don't need to cling on your colleagues' party. Having done a lot of shoddy deals in the past, and we didn't keep quiet, but we were patient, waiting for the right time for him to declare that he's in NRM. And then you say we are jealous. Jealous of what? He's an embarrassed man to the public and the global, those people who used to take him very seriously. So disappointed. That is why he cannot go into the Democratic Union of Africa. He cannot come attend the IDU meeting, which is coming in next October in Washington. He cannot go to the conservative conferences, which used to be his domain. So people do not understand him. But they can understand him as a minister in a ruling government when the states are dealing with state-to-state interactions. There, we don't have a problem, and the rest of the people cannot have a problem when he's working as a minister.
Dr. Lulume Baiga is a member of parliament from the opposition Democratic Party, or DP. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Tanzania, President Samia Suluhu Hassan has named Minister of Energy January Makamba as new Minister for Foreign Affairs and East African Cooperation. He replaces Stergomena Tax, who now returns to the Ministry of Defense, a position she had held before being sent to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. The announcement was contained in a statement in a major reshuffle of the cabinet. Doto Biteko, who was the Minister of Mines, replaces Makamba as the new Minister of Energy, Mines and Natural Resources, and will also become the new Deputy Prime Minister. Political observers say the latest cabinet reshuffle appears to be a move for the president to consolidate power in preparation for the coming elections in 2025. For reaction to the cabinet reshuffle and the latest development, I reached Faraja Lugumi. He is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
As I've been talking to people, they are divided. There are different reactions, but most of the observers they think the president is preparing herself for the 2025 general elections for that three reasons. One is because the lake zone is very critical for the votes, especially when it comes to election. And the former president, the late Dr. John Pombe Magufuli, was loved so much by the people in the lake zone. And they are the ones who command the majority of the votes during elections. And so she would wish to win that region. And in order to win the voters, he's trying to pull the politicians on his side, the politicians from that side, to be on her side, at least to attract the voters that Samia is still on their side.
Dr. Stergomena Tax was regarded as one of the most experienced hands when she served as the SADC General Secretary at the time. She was very influential.
Yes,
she had exposure, and people hailed the president for appointing her. Within less than 2 years, she's been changed. Why?
People had some expectations on her. Unfortunately, it seems as if she has disappointed those who had more expectations on her abilities. I think her personal character has led herself astray, and I think that's why she has fallen away in favor of the president, because of her character in the ministry. Some people are accusing her of being arrogant, selfish, and lacking leadership skills, especially when it comes to teamwork spirit. She could not create a team to deliver the agenda of economic diplomacy in the ministry. And I think that's the reason. And the other thing that to attribute is that recently, President created a committee to investigate issues in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as to why the government and the country is not performing well in the economic diplomacy. And people are trying to think, maybe in that report, the first draft of the report, maybe the report has hinted about the weakness of the minister in implementing the economic diplomacy, and maybe that might be one of the reasons that pushed the president to pick another person for the docket, because she has a feeling maybe the person whom she trusted to be the best pick out has disappointed her.
What does this cabinet reshuffle mean for the East Africa community, especially with the new foreign minister, General Makamba? What does that mean for the East Africa community?
General Makamba, I can say, is a young person. He was a close person to Jakaya Kikwete. And Jakaya Kikwete is one of the elders in the region who is highly respected. He brought peace in Kenya after post-election violences. Jakaya Kikwete participated in the peace and negotiations in Kenya, and Januari was there as one of the closest person to Jakaya. And so Januari was brought up during the period of Jakaya, when Jakaya was performing very well in the issues of international relations. So that might make more sense for January in the ministry, because he knows a lot of issues. I think he will bring more ideas to the president and more advice, as he has been so influential in international relations during the time of Jakaya, and the way he has been doing things in the past. Maybe I can see him bringing the East African community in the hands of Tanzania as an influential politician who can do well in the Ministry of East African community and international relations, as many people there will know him, and he can consult his previous colleagues in the ministry, and I think they can strategize better our international relations and our international agenda when it comes to East African community and other regional blocs.
Faraja Lugume is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, but first. A deadly record drought in the Horn of Africa has killed vast numbers of cows, goats, and sheep, imperiling the livelihoods of pastoralists like the Maasai in Kenya, who rely on livestock for food and income. Now, a U.S. charity called Water is Life Kenya is helping herders by giving them new animals and cash. For VOA, Juma Majanga reports from Ekongu Narok village in Kenya.
On the slopes of Mount Kilimanjaro, overlooking the Amboseli National Park in Kenya's southern border with Tanzania, residents of Ekongu Narok village sing in celebration. Thank you, God, our provider, they sing in traditional Maasai prayer song. The Maasai, like other pastoral communities, depend on livestock as their main source of food and livelihood. They are still reeling from the Horn of Africa's worst drought in four decades and its toll on their animals. As Ekongu Narok Area Chief Daniel Lekei explains,
it was a three-year drought, swept a lot of livestock. So almost everyone is very, very desperate in their life because of they cannot get enough food, they cannot take their children to school.
Today they sing joyous songs to celebrate the arrival of donations. Water is Life Kenya, a U.S. and Kenyan-based charity, is helping vulnerable families in the pastoral communities affected by drought by giving them new cows, goats, and sheep, as well as cash, so they can rebuild their lives. The grant program, now in its second year, also provides herders with skills so that they can better cope with the frequent droughts brought on by climate change. Joyce Tanyan is the co-founder and director of Water is Life Kenya.
We know that people here, you know, happiness is really built on livestock and it's a good asset to have. And also goats give birth. And so you're building your assets. And so we said, okay, the grant will help them have everyday money, you know, money so that they can feed their families. And the goats will be like a savings.
Narisein Toki, a 26-year-old widow and mother of four, is one of the over 30 widows who are each receiving three goats and $200 cash grant on this day. Her family lost all their nearly 100 cattle to drought, and Ntoki says she is eager to start over. She says for now she doesn't have any livestock at home, but today she is getting some goats that will help her start over and grow them to many, adding that God will help her multiply them. Koyaso Sunte, also a widow and mother of six, received her grant last year. She says she used the money to start a bead-making business. Suta says she saves half of the profit she gets from selling beads and sets it aside to pay school fees. The money she gets is not that much, she adds, but it is helping her take care of her family. The record drought killed nearly 10 million livestock across the Horn of Africa, imperiling livelihoods of pastoralists like these Maasais. Water is Life Kenya says while the grant helps only a relative few, it is helping some of those most affected restore some of their lost livelihoods. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Ekongu Narok Village, Kenya.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Make up on the physical.
Continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a dead person shall have all the sleep necessary. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.